You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week, disaster tourism. Sometimes human behaviour is very hard to understand. How cricket is changing and nobody knows about it. And Terence has been invited to a wedding. Ta-da! And Juliet advises him on etiquette and unravels the mystery of just giving lists. It's all coming up after Foo Fighters and Times Like These.
I'm not necessarily a huge subscriber to the Foo Fighters oeuvre, but I've always enjoyed that. I think it's rather a cheery tune. And they did do, one of the B-sides to it was a version of Planet Claire by the B-52s, which I've never heard but would like to. So that was the Foo Fighters. The song was called Times Like These, and it came from their album One by One, which, again, time passes, doesn't it? It came out in 2003, apparently. It reminds me of being at university, so none of us are getting any younger, it would seem. It had some chart success. It got to number 12 over here, and it got to 65 on the Billboard 100 in the US, and it did quite well in their kind of alternative charts over there as well.
Did you see that YouTube footage during the week of Dave Grohl's 8-year-old daughter, Harper, playing drums with them on stage in Iceland this week?
Yes, I did.
This was sweet, wasn't it?
It was sweet, and of course you know that she was going to be good because she's Dave Grohl's, isn't she? And Dave Grohl, the TM nicest man in rock, apparently.
He does seem to be, yes.
And they, of course, are finally getting to headline Glastonbury on the day that we're recording this, Saturday, the 24th of June. Mm-hmm. They get to headline Glastonbury tonight, which is great, considering that they were going to a few years ago and couldn't because Dave Grohl broke his leg. And Florence and Her Machine fame were bumped up to be the headliner to replace them. And they did a version of this song, I think.
Ah, so
which Dave Grohl was very pleased about.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing them on the TV or at Glastonbury.
Well, you literally have the T-shirt, don't you?
I literally do.
The follow-on
from
our previous conversation. So that's going to be enjoyable for you, no doubt.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 312. I'm Terence Stackham. And who do we want? Juliet Harris. When do we want her? Now. Who do we want? Juliet Harris. When do we want her? Now. Little echo there from the Andrea Leadsom campaign of a year ago.
Absolutely. Well, you're in luck if I'm the one you want, because here I am. But yes, whenever I think I'm having a bad day or things have gone wrong, I will at least I can say that I'd never march to insist that Andrea Leadsom become leader of the Conservative Party. Her supporters, I remember Dan Hodges at the time writing that if her supporters, Margaret Thatcher's extreme supporters were labelled headbangers, and so he labelled her supporters leadbangers, which I thought was quite good.
Now, Jules, I was watching cricket on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, as it happens, but more of that later. And I gave my friend Paul a lift back to Notting Hill afterwards. There was some confusion between him and his partner. He thought she was going to pick him up. He then realised he's left his house keys at home. It was all a bit Fawlty Towers. Yeah, it was sort of all very Basil and Sybil, actually. So we headed to Notting Hill and sat outside the Elgin pub. Got talking to a few people. And, of course, the disaster, you sit outside the Elgin, the table's very close together, easy to get chatting to people. The disaster of Grenfell Tower was on everyone's mind. It had only been a few days before. And it's only a couple of hundred yards away from the Elgin pub. And as we, I think, mentioned last week, you really do have people living in social housing and some people living in quiet poverty situations, really literally 20 paces away from people living in some somewhat more hedonistic lifestyles in Notting Hill. I heard a lot of stories from the sort of local people, some very disturbing that I won't repeat here. But one aspect that several people were very annoyed about in the Grenfell Towers area was that police resources are being used to keep control of the people, I'm calling them disaster tourists, who were turning up in sizable numbers to get as close as possible to the remains of the tower and take photos. And I was so surprised by this that a young couple that we didn't know insisted we went along to see for ourselves. Now, I must stress that we didn't go too near at all. We stayed a good street or so away, didn't get in the way, and nor, of course, did we take any pictures ourselves.
Of course,
that would have been
absolutely
against the whole, what I'm saying. But then we saw them next to large handwritten signs everywhere that said, "Please don't take photos, please show respect," were dozens of people. This was about 8:30 at night. Dozens of people on Monday pushing against blue and white police tape, some ducking under it, taking photos, taking selfies of themselves with Grenfell Tower as a backdrop, some doing like FaceTime and saying, "Can you see it now? Can you see it now? It's terrible, isn't it?" And I had a quick word with one policeman who was very wary of saying anything, I have to be fair. But he confirmed to me that this goes on all day, every day, a steady stream of people staring and taking photos. And I wonder, Jules, am I harsh in thinking these people should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves?
Well, no, I don't think you are. And I am struggling, since we said we were going to talk about this. I am struggling to try and find a way to defend people on this, because I was thinking there must be something I can extrapolate from this. Mm. Do you remember we talked ages ago about the chap, was his name Beninus, that was on that plane that got hijacked?
Oh,
and he did
a selfie with himself. With a terrorist,
and, and I thought... my argument for that was that he might have somehow been doing it for self-preservation. Mm. That was, of course, I thought, perhaps a clever way of identifying them, or maybe he was in shock. It's difficult here. If there were people that lived there or lived in the local area, you might be able to make an argument that they were going around to try and process what was happening, if you see what I mean, in their local neighbourhood. But if you're travelling from somewhere else to see it, it does feel like rubbernecking, and I do have a problem with it, I must admit. It does feel a little bit, you know, I was there, if you see what I mean. And there's quite a lot of I was there. And I suppose, interestingly, I mean, there seems to be more think pieces about Instagram now than there are about anything else, really. And you know, the idea that you know, a good looking model writes about her Instagram hell because she constantly feels like she's having to pose. There are more of those articles than there are actual Instagram accounts, I think. But I wonder if, I'm just trying to think about how we got here, really, because rubbernecking, you know, motorway accidents and stuff, that's always been a thing, hasn't it? That you always know if there's an accident on one side of the motorway because you get stuck in traffic on the other side of the motorway, because everyone wants to have a look. So that's not a new thing. But I wonder if the culture of stuff like Instagram and, you know, the everyone's hunger for hashtag content means that you know, you want to be able to say on your Instagram the picture of the burnt out town, all this is terrible. And there are an awful lot of people that fancy themselves as have a go pundits nowadays, and I know this is a bit rich considering we're doing a podcast every week where we are just that, but there are lots of people that, you know, I come across them on Facebook and in some of the political groups that I'm in, where I can smell them a mile off now, I must admit, where you see people who, you know, make their public statement on something. And, you know, I think it's for everyone to comment on things. And, you know, I often do as well. But there are some people who you can just sense their self-importance, I think. And I know of some people who I think would go and do that so that they could pass themselves. There are a lot of people trying to pass themselves off as news reporters. There is one particular two public figures around the Grenfell Tower, one on the news and one on Twitter. I won't name them, I don't think, but there are a couple of people who, you know, I find frustrating that they, I'm not saying that you can't diversify in from one area to another, but I find it frustrating that these people are you know, very self-importantly telling us their thoughts on things, when it's like, do you know what, you weren't there,
yes,
you don't
exactly.
live there, you don't have a connection to there. This is why I feel for politicians as well, because this is why journalists, and I will name this, but journalists like Paul Mason and Russell Brand, although you put in journalist in inverted commas with him, I think, but people that kind of try to whip this up with, you know, they're all the same, politicians are all the same, people that have tried to whip that frenzy up for years. We're now in this situation where it almost feels like politicians can't do right for doing wrong, really. Mm. And I do have some sympathy. And I would say, again, it's very easy to be an armchair pundit. It's not quite as easy to be making these enormous decisions. And even if you have held yourself out and made your own problems, in the case of Theresa May, I do have sympathy. I can't pretend that I don't.
One quick last point on that, on something you mentioned a few minutes ago, the sort of rubbernecking on motorways. I've noticed this myself, as you say, it's an accident in the opposite direction. People are slowing down to rubberneck at the crash. But I've even seen people in cars around me, drivers, grabbing their phones to take photos from the opposite carriageway. And I actually looked into this week because I was, like you, seeing a link between the Grenfell Tower people as well. And I found it such a problem now that the Highways Agency is rolling out a trial of incident screens to shield the scene of an accident to try and keep traffic moving, which doesn't show humanity at its best at all.
No, it doesn't, does it, really?
Coming next, we're looking at what may be a revolution in cricket in England, but nobody seems to know about it. That's next, right after Al Matthews.
Much too easy to love you, but time.
1970s, I worked at Capital Radio for a while, and there was this larger-than-life fellow who was a Vietnam War veteran, and he seemed to have worked all over the world, and he rolled up at Capital to present a soul show. And then one day he came in and he said, "Oh, I'm putting a record out." And the next thing, he's on Top of the Pops, and the single was at number 16 in the UK Top 40. Yeah, that was it. It was a summer hit in 1975. It was Al Matthews and Fool.
I thought that was excellent. And the funny thing is that, and I've almost feel like I've turned into someone's confused elderly parent, that I was going to follow that up by saying, it's good to check Google first, or I would have made a complete tool of myself. Ah, so it's nice to hear a song by him that isn't Year of the Cat, but it turns out that's Al Stewart. So you can call them all Al, it turns out.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I was at the cricket at Lords for 3 days this week, watching a hugely enjoyable county cricket championship match between Middlesex and Yorkshire. Middlesex won very soundly in 3 days. What was noticeable by its absence was any mention of a rather large revolution in cricket that's happening next week. We're in June 2017, if you're listening in the future. And this is like a big shot at saving the future of county cricket, which is struggling with attendances, let's be honest. And it seems to be woefully underpublicised. What's happening next week, Jules?
Well, we are living through the age, Jones. We can tell our all of our successors in title that that we are living through
we
the
were
age
there.
Of yeah, we were living exactly. We were there, but not taking pictures. Mm. We were living through the age of the pink ball in cricket. So traditionally, cricket is played with a red leather ball. For what my dad rather uncharitably refers to as pajama cricket, which is kind of this one day type cricket. They sometimes use different kind of hardier balls. So
a white ball, in fact, indeed, in the 2020, yeah.
And I've played cricket with orange balls before, kind of orange plasticky balls. So they use different kind of types for that. We will have a pink Duke's ball at Edgbaston in August when England play the West Indies in a day-night test. And it will be in county championships games from Monday. The Guardian do an excellent weekly newsletter called The Spin to do with cricket. And it's really good. I would recommend it. And I will read from this if you don't mind. These are rather lovely little pink things are made at the endearingly ramshackle warehouse that is Duke's North East London home. And Dilip Jajodia, the company's boss, is explaining the process to The Spin. Basically, it's a den of where they're making 120,000 balls. Everything's done by hand, from the milling and the polishing to the notes and the labelling, and then they're sent round the world, basically. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of this is Gary Balance, who is Yorkshire's captain and who is an England international as well, is colourblind, which I did not know. And he's been working with... And we've laughed previously about, you know, how I wish to be the official breakfast cereal of the World Cup one day and how everyone has these bizarre roles nowadays. Yorkshire have a club optician. Wouldn't you like to be Yorkshire's club optician? That has developed lenses that allow him to play. And he will take part, but he hasn't decided whether or not he's going to wear his... natty new specs that's going to kind of help him see this. So I'm interested by this. I'm very interested to see whether it's just another novelty or whether it's been introduced because I hope that cricket doesn't go the same way as football in terms of being dominated by money and the whole enterprise is seemingly structured around when it can be shown on television. And maybe, you know, the pink ball, it can be seen, you know, during the day and during the night. So maybe, as it's being used at Edgbaston in August. So I don't know if this is a brilliant new innovation or if it is the beginning of the end of cricket being the game that we know it is.
Well, that's the fear. And this is the critical thing, is this day-night aspect of it. And what it is, what's the big revolution in county cricket that it's mainly aimed at, I think, is that they believe this pink ball is easier to see at night because there's a full tranche, the whole wedge of county cricket championship matches next week, which has been woefully underpublicised, as I say, that are for the first time in 150 years of history of county cricket are going to be day-night games, in other words, played under floodlights in the evening. And or hopefully without floodlights if the weather is good enough. Now, that means games are going to start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, the county game is struggling. Crowds of a few hundred in grounds that hold 20,000. Not a good look. And these days there are fewer people who have the time and resources to spend full days at cricket right through the summer. And, of course, there's many more distractions these days if you do have time to do that. In the golden era, the PG Woodhouse days, I suppose, a fellow either went to his club. Absolutely, or to the cricket, and we have more options life now. But so the county games starting next week are all going to start, instead of the traditional 11 o'clock a.m. starting time, are all going to start at 2 o'clock, and they're going to be put in blocks of sessions. And one sadly typical bizarre part of this day-night cricket is the pricing strategy. The aim is to get more people in as the games will continue, as I say, into the evening, but it isn't a joined-up strategy, and this is where the county authorities have got it so wrong.
Some
counties are insisting you pay for the whole day.
There's a thing I've just
regardless of when you arrive.
Absolutely.
Others.
I mean, Glamorgan are pricing it per session, and Yorkshire, Sussex and Essex have a price for the final two sessions to target the 5 p.m. crowd. At Edgbaston and Northampton, the final session is free, but that's the case for any championship.
You see what
game
I mean?
How
ridiculous is this? You see what I mean? So, depending on where you live in the country, you're either going to have to pay for the full day, you're going to pay a part payment to come in and watch one session, or in one case, you're going to get in free. Absolutely ridiculous.
Absolutely. But I think that it's partly been introduced, though, to again, it's depressing that money is the driver on this, but it seems like they're trying to see whether bringing long-form cricket, condensing it down and playing it in the evenings will bring a new crowd. And it says here that Warwickshire say that 45% of buyers for August test have never been to a test at Edgbaston before.
But bearing in mind... cricket matches, test matches last for 5 days, county cricket matches last for 4 days. I can't see this working. I'll just quickly say why. Who would want to pop in for 2 hours of the second day between Warwickshire and Durham? Other than the one-off, the curious, you might pop in at once to say, oh, let's see what that's about. Let me put it this way. It's a bit like being invited to go and watch Chelsea play Manchester United in the Premier League, but you only get in to see the first 20 minutes after half-time, and then someone comes along and says, oh, you haven't got a ticket for the rest of the game, mate, you've got to leave now, and somebody else comes in and sits in your seat. It doesn't make sense. That's the problem.
No.
I hope it works, because I want cricket to thrive, but I can't see this as anything more than a crazy novelty.
Yeah, no, I agree, and it'd be interesting to see... be interesting to see what happens with it, really. And like I said, I hope this isn't, you know, I can see
well,
why
all
they're
about
having
money.
To
it's all about money and
cricket,
sponsorship.
But yeah, absolutely. And it's a pity.
Mm. I'm going to a wedding in a few weeks, and I need some advice. So I'm going to be turning to Juliet.
I'm about double uh-oh, frankly, but anyway.
That's next after XTC.
World's making sense.
one of the great mysteries of life is the lack of international stadium filling success for XTC. That's a track from their final studio album, amazingly 17 years ago.
Wow.
From Wasp Star, that's XTC and Stupidly Happy. Now, weddings are often troublesome for everyone, except the bride and groom.
Sometimes for the bride and groom. Married, yes.
Well, it's the actual wedding ceremony, all the hanging about, the formalities. Having said that, the last wedding I went to a couple of years ago was the best I've ever attended. It was held on the excellently named Monkey Island on the Thames at Windsor.
Oh, yes, I do like Monkey Island a lot.
Disappointingly, there are no monkeys on Monkey Island, which was a letdown, I have to say. But the couple got everything right at the wedding. I went to a lovely ceremony. And then crucially, and I think this is so important, when all the photos were being taken, which often takes way longer than scheduled, they'd organised a delightful area for all the guests to sit down, mingle, get cups of tea, pots of tea, that sort of thing, drinks and that, and then only popping out when needed for the odd photo before sitting down again. And this is exemplary for me. But most weddings are like an assault course to the senses. Mm. They drag on, and you need to have the stamina of a lion to survive. These days, I understand there's often themes. You're forced to wear a specific colour kind of clothing, colour coding as a guest. The venue might be decked out in a theme to resemble a Moroccan souk or a Russian space station. It's all terribly confusing. And now I understand I may be sent a just giving list. What's going on, Jules?
Well, there are many things to unpack with weddings, aren't there? So I, like you, it depends how well I know the people for the wedding, to be honest. And I was invited to a wedding years ago by some people that I'd been at law college with. Mm. And I don't mind buying somebody something for their wedding. And actually, in a way, I am more offended by people blatantly asking for money for their honeymoon. I find that weirdly more offensive than people saying, we're setting up home, can you buy us this? And I suppose really it's a sign of the times, I guess, that for example, when people of my parents' generation were getting married in the 70s, quite often living in sin was discouraged. Though having said that, my parents completely ignored that advice and my mum had been married already, so go them. But so quite often people hadn't lived together beforehand, so they were setting up a home, and that's what the point of wedding lists were, really, that you could buy them things like they would need, like towels and a kettle and that sort of thing. And these people already lived together but produced this wedding list from, I can't remember, John Lewis or Debenhams or somewhere like that. And the idea is that you went into the shop and took the wedding list in, and a nice lady would go to the computer and would produce a version of the list that would show what had been bought already and what hadn't, and then you go around the homeware department and buy what you wanted. This particular wedding, I got jostled a lot, so there was a lot of pressure on me to make sure that we were sent an email reminder to make sure we'd looked at the list and that we didn't miss out. And I was irked by this, Terence, I must admit. So I performed my own form of protest by following the list and buying them something that they put on the list, and so they received a wrapped-up toilet brush from me as their wedding gift, because it was on the list, and that was pretty much how I felt about things by that point. In terms of...
It's a shame, isn't it, that it goes to that degree.
And I think that in terms of... I mean, they asked for it, literally, so they can't complain. But anyway, I haven't seen them for years, oddly. But, but I think that... Yes, who saw that one going? But I think I hope I still have notoriety in their house as the person that bought them the toilet brush, if indeed they're even still together. And this is another thing, isn't it? Usually one finds the bigger and grander and more look at me, this look at me again, isn't it? And more look at me is. The wedding is, the less likely that marriage has a chance of success, I feel. And I'm very interested. There is a programme that I enjoy watching on TV called Don't Tell the Bride, and it is, you know, junk TV at its junkiest, and I just enjoy watching it. I refuse to embrace the concept of guilty pleasure, because I don't feel guilty for any pleasure or anything that I like. Having said that, I don't widely publicise my love of Don't Tell the Bride, but I don't know if you're familiar with this, Terence, but
I've not seen it. I know of it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, the concept of it is that they give the groom something like £20,000 or a sizeable budget, and I could have that wrong, actually, but they give them they give the groom a budget, 3 or 4 weeks in which to organise a wedding in which the bride has no input into. So the groom has to do everything. The groom has to choose the dress, which is often very vexatious. The groom brilliantly has to organise the hen do as well. And the amount of times that you've seen the stag do somewhere like Prague, and then you see the hen do sat there rather gloomily at bingo or something, where it's not quite as not quite as there really. And I think it's great. I really. Oh, it's £12,000 apparently.
Crikey.
It was £14,000 on the BBC One version because it started off life on BBC Three, and it was really interesting because, again, often, as you say, the groom had to pick a theme. And I remember, my favourite ever episode was with this couple who I felt sorry for the man a bit because he just kept making the wrong decisions and he was trying really hard and his bride was a bit sniffy about it all. And he was almost, he felt, I think, pressured into trying to do a theme. And the one thing that he seized on, and in a way it was kind of quite telling, that you think you'd know quite a lot about someone if you were going to get married to them, wouldn't you? And that you know a lot about their tastes and the sort of things that they like, you and, you know, what they like to... The only thing that he seemingly could find to desperately seize on was the fact that the bride likes chocolate. So he decided he was going to do, or to theme the wedding around Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Lord.
So he hired some small waiters to be Oompa Loompas. And everything was dressed up. And the best thing was that so they were running around everywhere. When the bride sort of turned up to the reception venue, it was almost edited television at its best, because the bride is kind of, and there's chocolate fountains everywhere, and the bride is a bit unsure about it and it doesn't seem terribly impressed. And this information has obviously been relayed to the groom, who then says, oh, well, I'm a bit worried about this now then. And the camera pans back to reveal the groom dressed as Willy Wonka.
Oh, my God.
It was one of the best things. And I think in the end, and they did their first dance with him dressed as Willy Wonka. It was busted television. I think she did see the funny side in the end. But it was very entertaining. So I'm quite a fan of this kind of when weddings go wrong. And speaking of when weddings go wrong, I hope, Terence, at the wedding that you go to, will not be like this wedding. There's been some dispute as to whether this story is true or not, I must admit. So I'm just trying to look this up. But it is quite entertaining. This was a story that was kind of popular on social media. I'm taking this from the Mirror. So you might remember the group S Club 7, who were
Seven.
You might remember that there was a kind of a if you pardon the pun, a Hitler Youth version called the S Club Juniors, who were small children. They started off as S Club Juniors, and then I think they were S Club 8, or maybe the other way around. Okay. I don't know. Anyway, two of them went on to be in the Saturdays.
Oh,
and
okay.
Not all of them enjoyed the same level of success. And one of them was a lady called Stacey McLean. She got married to a footballer called Fraser Franks recently. And she claims that this is overstated, the stories. So Stacey and Fraser
I dread to hear what's coming next.
Stacey and Fraser spoke out after a source told The Sun that Stacey made a speech in which she jokingly told the guests that she hated them all before throwing cake at the groom. She'd had some drink, I think. Yeah. The insider said, I think she thought she was being funny, but he took it really badly. They had a huge bust-up. Stacey, 28, reportedly posted on Facebook afterwards, I'm sorry to all the people I didn't get to see because I drank on an empty stomach and was an absolute mess. Dear. The stress of planning a wedding and not accepting help as I'm such a control freak took its toll. She's since then posted a string of photos from the wedding to Instagram alongside captions including the best day ever and I will love you forever. And they're now posting very cheery pictures from their Instagram, but the reports at the time said that apparently they had an enormous bust up and that she'd gone off to bed early without the groom. So I hope that your friends that you're going to are just going to throw cake at each other, have too much to drink and tell the guests that they hate them all. I think that is, in a way, I kind of salute her, really. I hope that is true.
That reminds me, actually, just made me remember about 5 years ago, I didn't go to this wedding for reasons that will immediately become obvious. About 5 years ago, someone I worked with, better not say her name. decided to get married on a cruise ship. And they, what they did was they invited anybody that knew them, you know, that could come along on the cruise and, you know, as guests, but you had to pay for yourself.
Oh, and it's, isn't it?
Yeah, nobody went. Even her parents couldn't afford, because it was like a Caribbean cruise and they couldn't afford, you know, to pay for it. And I just remember her showing the photos when they came back, and all the wedding photos just showed them, her in the wedding dress and her a bridegroom in a suit, but they were just surrounded by crew members from the cruise.
And that, isn't that just awful?
It's so terrible.
And it just goes to sum up, and actually this is my problem with some weddings, and I think this is the heart of the matter, isn't it? The weddings that I have enjoyed the most and that I've really remembered as being great days have been the weddings where you feel like a guest and you don't feel like a walk-on. And I think that exactly sums it up, that I've been to weddings which I've hated, and regrettably in one case a family wedding, because I feel that they have been organized with complete contempt for the guests and with no consideration at all. That yes, it's lovely that someone wants you to be at their wedding, that's a really nice thing, but having said that, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should go to a great amount of expense and a great amount of inconvenience. And I will tell this nightmarish story. I have forgiven everybody involved now, but years ago one of my cousins got married up in London, and there was tension around the wedding anyway, because his mother had expected to be more involved in planning it than she was, I think. So, and the other mother was more involved, and so there was already, and I did feel for my aunt actually, and there was some tension, I think. And then they decided, the bride and groom, that they were going to say there were to be no small children at the wedding, that they should only, which is controversial, but I can kind of understand. But my aunt said, this is going to exclude our family, isn't it? So that the people's kids can be at the wedding. And they initially said, no, it's not. It applies to everyone. And that caused another great big bust up. And in the end, that did row back slightly. And I probably would have been in my, maybe I'd have been about 13, I think. I certainly wasn't that old. So the wedding was in Twickenham. So we had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to drive up from Hastings to Twickenham. I had a migraine on the way there and really did not feel at all well. So I was then shuffled off into a back bedroom when we got up there at my aunt's house. And so I was not feeling great by this point. Of course, we'd had breakfast in the morning. We went off to this wedding, which was in a large stately home. And it was a very nice venue, to be fair. But I'd met my other cousins there and my nan, of whom I'm very fond. So we all kind of hung out together and we had to have our picture taken, all that kind of stuff. And the wedding was, you know, to be honest, I can barely remember the ceremony, but it was obviously quite nice. But we were increasingly distressed by the fact that wedding was at something like 11 or 12. The wedding was bang in the middle of the day. And the wedding breakfast was not until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which meant that I hadn't eaten since about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I remember getting to about 2:30 and my cousin's wife and I, jokingly but not really, barracking my nan, who was going through her handbag trying to find anything in food form, in which we included Rennie's. I think I shared a Rennie with someone because we were so hungry. I had a packet of crisps in the bar when we got there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. My mum by this point was pretty cross, as was my dad, unusually, because I can remember my dad saying to someone, look, my child who's had a migraine this morning, who does not feel at all well, has not had anything to eat all day. I think there was also an issue because there was only wine at the immediate kind of after the wedding. They had to go and fix out, you know, non-alcoholic drinks. When we eventually got to the evening reception, it was fine. You could have the option that you could book a room in the hotel, because it was in a sort of a pub kind of hotel-y type, an upmarket pub hotel type place. And we met a nice couple and a daughter who was a similar age to me, so we got on quite well. We'd been seated at the same table, I suspected it, but they were a really nice couple. And they were on the bride's side, and they'd come from somewhere up north, I think. And my mum and dad had asked them, oh, so are you staying upstairs then? And they said, oh, well, no one told us.
Oh.
And you just think, oh, for goodness. And it just felt, I mean, they are still together, but it just felt like the day was I mean, and I think that, that afterwards they might have regretted that, I think. But it just felt like, you know, I didn't feel particularly valued or nurtured as a guest. And, you know, we were directly related to them, you know. It was my mum's sister's son, you know. We were, if not close family, then certainly extended family. You know, we saw them quite a lot. And it was just, and I think I just have a problem with people who, yes, I know it is your special day. I know that. Mm. And I know that obviously the memories are yours. But equally, if you're wanting people to celebrate with you, as your cruise couple prove, then you need to obviously realise that people, you know, everyone has different budgets, and we could spiral off into a chat about hen and stag dudes, I think, and the increasing kind of demands that people put on. We've all got to go away for a hotel, and this has got to happen, and that's got to happen. Actually, the best, I was involved in organising a hen do a few years ago, and it was the best ever, and I was a bridesmaid at the wedding, and that was a great wedding, because it was all done, not on the budget, but it was all done, you know, they didn't have huge expectations. They just wanted a nice day where all of their local friends and family could come. And my friend's hen do, she said to the, that she had three senior bridesmaids and two junior bridesmaids. Mm. She said to the grown-ups, she said to one person, we all had kind of expertise in different areas. And she said, I want to go off for a walk, a nice walk. I'd like to have somewhere, a nice pub to eat in. And I'd like Juliet to organise something musical in the evening. So what we did was, I had a bad back, so I couldn't go on half of it. But they went on a big hike across the South Downs, because this is where we live, so very fortunate. And because she had some friends with her that had sort of disability type needs, they found a sort of an accessible walk, and then they went to a pub. And then it was the start of my DJing career, because I DJed her Northern Soul themed disco in their basement flat, which was excellent. And then the next day, everyone stayed with her. So, or I put someone up, I think, as well. So no one had to pay for a hotel. And then the next day, we all had breakfast at their house, and we made some bunting for the wedding. So we all sat there, and she provided all the materials, and I thought that was great, because it didn't come with any of these expectations around weddings and stag and hen do's that you have to pay £450 to go on a drink up in Prague or anything. So actually, hooray for weddings. I'm very glad for you if you're getting married or you know someone that is. But I would say to people, if you do want to have a genuinely special and enjoyable day, it's important that the people that go should be considered and should be cared for, and they should have a good day as well, because then you end up on a cruise with nobody there.
I completely agree. Keep it simple, and possibly keep it short. And I've got a couple of tips that I from my experience.
Wedding tips.
Ban speeches unless your father-in-law is Giles Brandreth or Henry Blofeld. Don't have speeches. I think they always are excruciating. Give people, I think you mentioned it, give people simple food and drink. Give it to them early. Let them dance around a bit. Make sure everyone goes home at about 10 p.m. The problem always starts after 10 p.m. People have had a few too many drinks, and then the punch-up starts. So 10 p.m. Don't let your son's band play their set of Green Day cover versions.
Yeah, fair enough.
Get a DJ like Juliet, just play Motown classics and Northern Soul, that's it. Don't take 5,000 photos. Take 50 and take them all in 30 minutes.
Absolutely.
And don't host the wedding in Barbados and expect all your guests to pay their way. Other than that, as you say, knock yourself out.
Yeah, have a great day. Actually, interestingly, I DJed a wedding recently for some very dear friends of mine who I hadn't seen for a very long time. And they were sort of doing it on a budget because they had planned to get married, and then she lost her job. She has got a new job now. And in a way, it was an ill will, because it gave her time to project manage the wedding, and that's what she does for a living. So that was good. But they did it. So they had it in they got married in Grange Gardens in Lewiston, and then they had a wedding at the community hall. They're going to break some of your rules here, Terence, but I'm proving that it works. So I said that I'd DJ in the evening. I charged them for petrol, and that was pretty much it, because I just wanted to do it as a favour, and Lewis is not that far from where I live. So I drove over, took my laptop, so I didn't have to worry about records or debts or anything like that. And the plan was that it was in a community centre, the reception, and they had a meal which looked very nice, and that was sort of catered. It was kind of buffet style catering where you went up and they put the things on your plate. I got there in time for the Eton mess, so I had a large bowl of Eton mess, which was excellent. They had some friends of theirs had helped them dress the community hall beforehand. They made short speeches, all of which were excellent. Mostly because, and this is one of the best speeches I've ever heard at a wedding. The bride's father made a speech where he thanked everybody and said how nice it all was, and then he talked about the guests, and he listed about six things that various guests had done, like somebody had a Blue Peter badge and someone had done a skydive for charity, and then said, well, I won't talk anymore, but I'd like you to all try and find each other and make friends. And I was just so touched by that. It was a lovely speech. So they made some nice speeches. The difficulty came. The plan was to then do a Kaylee for eight, and so they had a cheery couple, a lady that did calling, and so there were a man that did an accordion. And as I went to set up to DJ after, then the man said to me, "I think some people have had a bit of drink," and there were various people walking into each other, but it was all very cheery and good natured. And then I like you say, did they asked for Motown, Northern Soul, ska and reggae, and a little bit of I did a bit of what I would call alternative 80s. So they wanted to do Let's Dance by Bowie as their first dance, which I did, and we did a few things like that. The only slight issue is that they were using the same room to eat in as they were using for the Kaylee, and it turns out it takes a very long time to take tables down and move them. Which I booked to start at 9, and I think I got on at 10:15. So said that though, it was a very good wedding, and it showed that most of your rules very much hold true, and that it was near a children's playground as well, so all of the kids could go and play on the playground, handy. Which I thought was great. That was really good. And so, but, you know, as long as, and also the best man gave a speech. And I think this is the speech that I hate the most about weddings, Terence, because the best man's speech is always kind of way lads, isn't it? And the groom actually said, oh, well, I guess I need to sit down now and prepare for the ritual abuse, which everybody found really funny. And the best man's speech was the most sincere I've ever heard. Huh. And he basically told stories about what a great guy the groom was, and how everything in his life he made a success of, and he was sure that this would be the same thing. And it was, everyone kind of cried because it was such a nice speech. It's unexpectedly pleasant. So yes, also, if you are going to have speeches, can you make them very nice and considerate, please, rather than, you know, I went to one once where someone showed a picture. The groom had a habit, apparently, of trying to take pictures of his siblings on the toilet, so we all had to sit picture of the glue on the toilet, which was obviously not ideal. So that's my tip. If you, I'm not anti-speech like Terence is, but can you make them nice and preferably short?
Sensible advice. Now, other than posting daily updates of the shirt or blouse you're wearing on social media,
this has gathered a cult following.
I particularly like the Paisley one this week.
Yes, they seem to have been particularly popular or unpopular. There's one lady who really does not like Paisley, it turns out. But anyway,
where might your people find you this week?
Well, I don't have a great deal of engagements this week, not Saturday social this evening, because it was last week, but I will be doing Indie Wonderland on Wednesday evening from 8 until 10, barricaderadio.com, where I play a mix of indie, alt-rock and miscellaneous, quite often themed, not always, and we'll be doing that this coming Wednesday.
Okay. Thanks, of course, to executive producer Rona, who is currently working on a massive project to raise money for the survivors of Grenfell Tower. So we wish her every success.
All best for that. Yes.
Absolutely.
I must read up on that and do something to help.
Yeah, she was featured, she was mentioned on the Channel 4 programme The Last Leg last night.
That's really good.
Talking all about our Rona and her project for Grenfell Tower. Now, last year you introduced me to a splendid album that I've really grown to love. It's from a sort of super group, Case Lang Veers, and we're playing out with a track from a solo album from one of those three.
Yes, indeed. And I was delighted when that album came out because I thought it was three amazing performers all coming together. And may I just point out, female performers coming together in a non-competitive way that I suspect that men might not have done. But anyway, part of the reason why I was so excited, obviously I knew Sam Nico Case and really liked it, and obviously, of course, I am familiar with Katie Lang, and being who I am a fan, of course. But Laura Veers, a friend of mine, it would have been about 2005, it was earlier than that, at university, a friend of mine had a Laura Veers album called Years of Meteors that he introduced me to, that I liked very much. I thought it was great. I didn't love it like he did, but I thought it was excellent. And then a few years later, I was a big reader of The Word magazine, of course, as all listeners know, we have the links there. And I came across a song by Laura Veers, which I listened to on their excellent monthly CDs that they did, because I knew of her stuff previously and liked it, that was called Pink Light, and I instantly fell in love with it. And I bought the album that it came from, Salt Breakers, and I thought it was a magnificent album. We've played Pink Light on here before. And every song on that album, I think, is great. And the thing that I love about it is it is so inspired by the natural world. That was very much her kind of natural world type album. I know that Years in Meteors to some extent is as well, but she's someone that really does have this amazing connection with the natural world. And we've been experiencing extremely sunny weather down here in Hastings. There have been lots of people swimming in the sea and, you know, going out for walks. And we're on the doorstep of the South Downs, and we're very lucky where we live. We have lots of things we can enjoy outside. And so it got me thinking about this album. And I just love this. I think it's so good. And I saw someone fishing the other day in the sea, and I thought of this. So this is Laura Veers, and this is Cast a Hook.
Breathe life to the street from your mouth. Those ruby red lips have much to give. Pull life from the land with your capable hands. Those life-loving, beautiful, broken hands. Oh, I'll stand with you and marvel at the cosmos pink. All the pages flipping backwards, till time is gone and wrong is right. Like rivers running up the hills into the sky and down to the sea. Where a merman with a twinkle casts a hook in me. Sing me a salty blue song, I'll be gone. With watery cheeks down flowered lanes, tattered sails on a ramshackle ship, I'll go pale, staring straight in the face, looming tempest waves. Otherwise I'll wither, die here on this reach of rubble, ramble lane, with two ears filled up with sand ear and a broken gaze, I'll be scrambling.
Have been listening to a DACA Media production.